You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I want to be a billionaire so fucking bad. Buy all of the things I never had. I want to be on the cover of Forbes magazine. Smiling next to Oprah and the Queen. Oh, every time I close my eyes, I see my name in shiny lights. Yeah, a different city every night. Oh, I swear, the world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire.
All right, so speaking of billionaires, joining me is Grant Newsham. Grant, I love it when we have wealthy people on, so welcome to the program. How are you?
Well, yes, I'm here counting my gold coins like Donald Duck's uncle. Yeah.
And then there you go. Okay, we're going to do the lightning round today, okay? So at the start of the program, lightning round. Thoughts on Brexit finally happening?
I think it's good. You know, if it was me, I would have, you know, I don't like being told like what to do, like a lot of Americans. So having people in Brussels who've never worked for a living telling me what to do, I think I would have bristled. And if I was British, I probably would have voted Brexit and damn the consequences as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking that too.
Yeah, I do wish Prime Minister Johnson had reached a different decision on letting Huawei, the Chinese telecoms company, into the British networks.
The 5G, development of the 5G. Can you even begin to understand that? I mean, for the rest of us, we watch it and it's like, this can't be happening. I mean, what in God's name, right, do they need to hire Huawei for when I'm sure there's other British telecommunications company that could do that work, that need that work? I just, for the life of me, Grant, it's like, to me, it's like, somebody's black. Somebody's got somebody, you know, Putin's involved in this someplace, but, but you know, explain it to us. I mean, how does it make sense from your perspective?
Oh, it's just stupidity. You know, there isn't any real explanation. You can get Westerners to do almost anything if you wave money in front of them. Westerners of a certain type. And the Chinese have gotten their financial inroads, their investments into Britain a long time ago. And that includes, for example, their prime minister a little while back, David Cameron. These guys just rolled over for Chinese money. Gave Xi Jinping a royal visit in 2015, promised that Britain would be China's best friend in Europe. And after Cameron left office, he set up an investment fund to invest in China. There is within we have the same thing. Just look at our financial guys. There's those people who will sell out their mother if there's money involved. But the Chinese have gotten their claws into Britain some time ago. And so I wasn't surprised to see this decision. But it's as stupid as you can possibly be, because it's sort of like letting a thief sort of live in your basement.
What was it? Was it Marco Rubio that said it's like this is like during the Cold War, allowing the Soviets, right, to build your embassy allowing them to put your phone system in?
That's what it is. I think it doesn't take too much effort, but you can have some sense of what one can do offensively with this sort of an opportunity. And allowing them to do it to us is just so stupid that serious thought needs to be given to whether or not the UK will be part of the so-called Five Eyes intelligence sharing agreement.
That's what was threatened last week, that if you have to know that there's, you know, if you allow them to be part of this infrastructure, the 5G infrastructure, it will come at a price. And it will come at our cooperation. So I don't. It'll be interesting to see if you know we stick to that. And it's more of that, you know, of that the elder Bush. You know, if as they become, you know, more integrated in the fabric of the world, these aspirations of world dominance will certainly go away as they, you know, as they round into a liberal, you know, socialist country. And that's not really happened. And and so it's just, I don't know, you look at it and it's just head shaking that the UK does not have another better option.
Yeah, you do have. I think it's Ericsson, and there's a couple. Nokia. There are a couple. Right. There are options, but just my sense of it, I don't think anyone believes China is going to change. And I think even the British, the people who have responsibility, have said basically that well, we have to deal with China as it is. But having been involved in the U.S. financial industry, when there's money involved, that people can convince themselves of anything. And you can rationalize away any problem, and I think that is ultimately what's being done. You know, just as Britain has sold out its nuclear industry to China, its steel industry, etc. But this is just one more thing, and it is as troubling as you can imagine. And I was hoping for a little more from Boris, but. Maybe I shouldn't have. I heard him described by a guy once as an excellent after-dinner speaker, which is different than saying an excellent potential prime minister. But I thought that applied to me pretty well.
Well, that's okay, because nobody's looking at you to become the prime minister. And so that's on Brexit. Now that it's official. How about on Megxit? Harry and Meghan Markle, headed to Canada.
Oh, goodness. One hardly knows what to say. You know, I don't have a sort of a stake in this at all. I remember the Japanese royal family when they brought in the crown princess. This was in the early 90s, as I recall. And she married into the family. And she was from an elite family. And they promptly drove her nuts. I think she came in thinking that she was going to transform this Japanese, the aristocracy and royal system, royal family, make it more modern. But what it's described to me as what is called the Imperial Household Agency, which are the bureaucrats who sort of run the emperor and that system. I heard them described as making the Taliban seem liberal. And I have a feeling that there's something like that around the British royal family as well, with the courtiers or the guys who oversee the sort of the royal system. That they're not exactly liberals nor very nice, and I suspect they're as petulant and vindictive and sort of prone to bullying as anyone, and then exponentially so. And then the British press as well is even more like rabid dogs than us. So maybe it's surprising that it didn't work out, but that is about the extent of, I try not to get too wrapped up in this sort of stuff, but you wish him the best, but boy, once this queen leaves, one wonders exactly what the attraction of the British royal family will be to many people.
Ornamental, maybe. Other than that, not so much.
Maybe like the Danish or the Austrian aristocracy that is there, but nobody really cares, pays
attention to it or cares about it. What about let's talk about the coronavirus. First of all, we were talking before we came on the air today, and Grant has a really funny story. So Grant, now I heard that the coronavirus came from mainland China because they were eating snakes. And Grant has a little bit of social media news, and that's moderately humorous and disgusting.
It is. When this thing finally sort of leaked out of the Chinese Communist Party's efforts to suppress it, one of the theories, and it was an internet sensation for a couple days, the idea was that the origin of this was from Chinese people eating bats, like Batman kind of bats. And it was like a YouTube video of this young Chinese woman who had a big, she had a bowl of bat soup in front of her, and in it, in the soup, was a bat, like a black bat that had been apparently, like, you know, fried in oil and then, you know, put to death that way. And she was just chowing down on a, like a whole bat, like eating its stomach and this sort of thing. And this is, it was, and but the theory was this is, you know, they, where it started or such like, something like that. But you, I, for the Marines listening, I would recommend watching, finding it. And I think if you just put Chinese woman eating bat into YouTube, you'll find it, because it makes the Cobra Gold sort of eat a cobra experience look like eating a hot dog, you know, by comparison. I mean, this, it, to me, it was repulsive. As repulsive as anything I've seen. But then, you know, we were talking and I thought about it. And well, you know, there's a lot of Southerners in the Marines who eat opossums and things like that. So maybe they will see it differently, but I would, maybe not. But this was pretty bad. And, but say that was one of the theories, is that the virus originated from the strange stuff that Chinese people eat and have always been eating. So I, well, that was sort of the funny part of it. But it is a serious serious thing. And it certainly highlights some of the, many of the shortcomings of the Chinese regime. But we don't, and we're curious where it will turn out that this actually came from. So we will see how that goes. But it certainly has put a damper on Chinese tourism in the region. It seems to have pretty much dried up.
The a little bit. Hello. The cities under quarantine and things like that. What impact has it had in Taiwan so far?
There isn't panic at all, but you know, people are aware of it and alert. But the Taiwan has pretty much has restricted sort of Chinese people from coming into Taiwan. Not entirely, but like no tourist groups, anyone who's been like coming directly from China, I think, I'm not sure they can even get in. Businessmen with some careful screening, I think, are allowed in, but they've really tightened up the border. The Russians have closed the border, the Mongolians, Hong Kong would if they were allowed to. Macau, I think, has also tightened it up. And
well, let me just tell you this. When the Mongolians closed the border, you know something serious is going on, okay?
Yeah, you do. So it's you know, we'll see. And one of the, of course, one of the sort of part of this puzzle is that in the city where it originated, in the city of Wuhan, that there's a very well-known virology lab, which is where you study viruses, and it'd be so that has of course raised some theory or some thought that maybe something leaked out of that lab, not just it didn't, and maybe it didn't come from a Chinese woman eating a bat. But it's not proven either way, and you know, one doesn't dismiss it, but at the same time, one doesn't. You have to wait and see, if the Communist Party will allow enough information to come out to actually ascertain where it came from. Given the nature of the regime and sort of routinely lying as a matter of course, it's just hard to take anything it says seriously. But one guy sort of compared it to, he mentioned, described it as, you know, suppose it's, say, Fort Detrick, Maryland, where they do sort of biological research.
Right.
Now, suppose people started getting sick around there. You know, you might at least consider as a possibility that something had happened at the laboratory. You know, it doesn't prove that it did, but it's something that would be considered. And you know, what you have noticed in the the mainstream media response to this theory is that people who even mention it are considered, you know, rubes or just really stupid. You know, it's just impossible. And one story I read in the Post said, Washington Post suggested, well, it couldn't have happened because they have airlocks at this laboratory.
Of course.
You know, I'm not making this up. And there was a little more to the article.
Because those things never malfunction.
Yeah, or, you know, and Chinese industrial hygiene is so perfect that, you know, what could possibly go wrong? But they have airlocks. But it was almost a desire. It was an intentional effort to dismiss or denigrate anyone who even suggested this possibility.
Well, that would ruin the narrative, right? The narrative that, you know, China's this refined nation, nobody's eating bat soup. You know, this is all, you know, propaganda from Western nations who've always run the Chinese down. And, of course, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, so. We'll see. You know, that's the thing, is you have to, you know, wait and see what the what facts come out. It is a system where the facts, if they're not in the Chinese Communist Party's favor, or they simply cannot avoid it, that you won't get the real story. But we'll see how this goes. It's but it's not panic in the street at all. Here it's, and I think they have. There's been prudent measures to try and isolate China, and try and isolate people from sort of infection. We'll see how it goes.
Are people from Taiwan allowed to go? You know, you mentioned that China has prohibited tourism or people going to Taiwan. What about Taiwanese people going to mainland China?
Now, I don't know how many of them want to go at the moment, but they, you know, if they can get there, I think it's okay. But it actually was the Taiwan government has actually, I think, put the stop to Chinese tour groups coming to Taiwan. But the Chinese government, the mainland Chinese government, has, I think, put limits on outbound tourism as well. But the one thing which is telling is the Taiwan government asked to send an airplane or two to Wuhan to remove Taiwanese people from the infected zone. And the communist part, the communist regime in China, refused to let Taiwan send the aircraft. Said, well, we're taking care of you, Taiwanese people, don't worry. And it's really this petulance on the part of the communist regime, which is troubling. It's characteristic. You know, Taiwan is not allowed even observer status in the World Health Organization by owing to the PRC's bullying. So here you have this outbreak of disease which is killing people, and Taiwan is not allowed to get information about it, even though Taiwan's medical system is probably better than the mainland China's by far. So it's, you know, you see this taking place in the sort of the context of this larger mainland Chinese effort to destroy Taiwan.
Right. Constant, unrelenting. Now, I want to ask you, something caught my eye. The BBC did an interview with Tsai Ing-wen, the president of Taiwan. Is that how you say that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it was about a 22-minute interview. And really, if I didn't know anything about Taiwan, I would have think at one point it was it had declared its independence from mainland China. I would believe that Taiwan was consistently attempting to provoke mainland China. And I played it, you know, I watched it, and then I played it on the show, and I said, listen to the intellectual premises of the questions to the president of a sovereign nation who has never ever been a part of, you know, mainland China, and that it is Taiwan that somehow or other is provoking China, and it was just honestly amazing, and coming from the BBC. And so I don't know if you saw that interview. But it was amazing to watch a major news outlet around the world with such a warped sense of what reality is in the region, and that you know, it was an interesting discussion as she articulated, you know, just the you know, he would ask her questions about, you know, why Taiwanese policy is a certain way, and she said she talked about the election. She said, well, we learned from the last election, where we did not have certain safeguards in place, and you saw the results in the election, as the Chinese mainland, you know, China, as they attempted, you know, to interfere with our election. And so, you know, he said, well, aren't you afraid that this will result in less freedom? She said, well, it has to be certainly very, very judiciously applied. She said, but we're pretty confident that we can spot what they do and that we can intervene appropriately. So I don't think the average Taiwan person has a whole lot to worry about. And I think that you saw, you know, between Hong Kong and our the events in Hong Kong and the our ability to keep fake news that was spread, you know, at a, I don't know what word she used, at a, at an incredible rate in the last election. I think you saw the difference when we took appropriate measures. And I was, you know, I'll tell you, Grant, that's the first interview I've ever seen with her. I was very impressed with her. But one of the things that constant throughout the interview was her saying China's unrelenting pressure on our country, and our the people of this country have understand it and are now in a position to push back. And then he started asking her about, you know, economic programs and also about military programs. You know, don't you think by acquiring, I think, F-16s or wanting to expand your military, that you're provoking China? And you're just listening to it going, geez, man, oh, man. So give me your thoughts on her and just the whole international narrative of, you know, of the position that Taiwan finds itself in.
Yeah, well, I didn't see the BBC interview, but I'm familiar with that kind of questioning and school of thought, which actually sees Taiwan as the problem. And you see it all over the place, and including in the U.S. media, but also in the U.S. government for a long time, and even still to some extent. But I've heard the president speak, President Tsai speak a few times, and actually heard her speak to a small group of people where I was able to attend. And she is really well spoken. You know, I would imagine she handled the interviewer very well.
Oh, very impressive. Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember when she was speaking to us, you know, and it was a short thing. I remember thinking, wow, I'd like to see her in front of the U.S. Congress. Because she really does put on just a very good, articulate defense of the idea of human freedom, which is really all that Taiwan's about. And she is correct indeed, you know, that she would know as much more than anyone, you know, just this unrelenting Chinese pressure on Taiwan to intimidate, to bully, to wear them down. You know, as you see it, you know, as I mentioned in, you know, the World Health Organization, where the Taiwanese are not even allowed to go sit. You know, they're not even, have generally not been allowed to, they're not allowed to be part of ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is just, you know, countries getting together to make sure their airlines don't crash in, you know, fly around the world safely and don't crash into each other. The Taiwan representatives have, you know, they've been involved in, they go to seminars around the world, in Australia, for example, and the Chinese demand that they not be allowed to attend. And it's really just simple stuff, but it's this constant bullying and hectoring and haranguing and just intimidation that gets tiring. And at some point, you know, Taiwan really, you do start to feel worn down and almost just give up. And I think that if it wasn't for the Trump administration, I'm actually doing more than any previous administration to support Taiwan, not least psychologically and verbally, that I'm not so sure that Taiwan could have resisted. But it is this idea, if you think you don't have any friends anywhere, at some point you just want to give up. But it does seem as though you know, Taiwan has gotten some more confidence back, and that is entirely, I think, in part a function of the U.S. and a few other nations providing a little more support, but also I think Hong Kong has done an excellent job, or the people who want to be free in Hong Kong have probably done more than the United States government has to sort of bolster Taiwan's psychology and its prospects, because it was as clear a reminder as you'll ever get of why Taiwan cannot cut a deal with China that would be acceptable. So, you know, Madam Tsai, it's important to remember, I think, that she does have a, like all leaders. They have both an international and then a domestic persona. And she's very good on, I think, international matters. Domestically, it doesn't matter who it is, you're always going to have a lot of enemies. You know, for whatever policies you put in place, it's going to irritate a lot of people. And so there is a surprising amount, no, maybe it isn't surprising, but there is, she does face a lot of opposition for some of her domestic policies, particularly involving national pension funds and things like same-sex marriage, etc., sort of these social things. But, you know, over, that's to be expected. And you know, she's done a good job, I think. And about a year plus ago, her prospects were terrible. She was very unpopular. Even her own party was thinking about getting rid of her. And yet, and Hong Kong came along and really turned things around for her. And I think it's a good thing for Taiwan. But this is, the game's not over. There's a long way to go to see how this plays out. And I think it will very much be a function of how much support the free world gives to Taiwan and as to whether or not it survives and just how this goes.
You've talked about the significance of the United States finally standing up on its hind legs. Do you believe that I mean, now when I watch, I see certain things that I haven't seen in the past. Malaysia taking the Chinese to the United Nations. And things that is the region emboldened by America's now no shit pivot to the Pacific?
I'm not sure if how direct the connection is, but right. I think there's probably there's an aspect to that, and I think what you stated I think is key to everything. I think that if the Americans appear genuinely committed and willing to fight, that I think you're going to find some of these wavering countries actually stop wavering quite as much. And Malaysia is a good example of that. Indonesia is probably an even better example. How much that has to do with the Trump administration and this apparent sea change in U.S. attitudes and policy towards China, I'm not sure. But I think it does have something to do with it. You do have these countries that they're scared of China. They don't want to be dominated by it. But if you don't think you have alternatives, you're going to cut the best deal you can. So it has been interesting to see the Malaysians and the Indonesians stand up a bit. The Australians have done better. There's still a long way to go here, I think, in terms of demonstrating U.S. commitment. And to the extent we're committed, and that ultimately that means willing to fight, that
nation. The Marine Corps is certainly committed. I mean, they can count on us. I mean, come on. We're all in, man, on 3MAP. You know, General Berger, every week, new statement about the best and brightest are going to 3MAP, right?
My goodness. You know, I show that best and brightest thing, but, I, of course, bristled a little bit. I think what it's because, one, the quality of Marine officers is generally pretty high, generally. And the idea, but what I'm afraid is when he says this, that it's going to attract what I would call the opportunists.
Right.
I think we may have talked about this, but you remember when the Afghan business started that suddenly everybody became counterinsurgency experts. They all came out of the woodwork. And so I'm afraid that whereas in actual fact, nobody wanted to do it because it wasn't where the cool guys were doing stuff. So all the people who had been interested in this and for a long time, they were, of course, trampled in the rush of the opportunists. And I'm afraid Marine Corps will be surprised at how many Asian experts they've always had. That said, I'm just, we just need to go about this carefully. But I think the focus is right. But and the Marines are, I think it's a good thing. But of course, it depends on the U.S. administration, and that's where I do have some concern. Is that this shift towards China policy has only really started in about 2016, after Mr. Trump was elected and had some of the right people in his administration who engineered this. And I'm afraid that if there is a change in administration, that we may just sort of shift back to this more accommodationist policy than before. Although there does seem to be a fair number of people who used to be accommodationists and got us into this mess are now saying the right things about having to take on China. You know, so we'll see how that goes, but I do have a little concern.
Right. No, I now have a more informed opinion on it. And you begin to watch, you know, different nations, you know, again, the nine dash line takes, you know, natural resources from nations. And then you begin to see what different countries are doing. It's pretty interesting stuff. And again, without American leadership in the region, then it's the bully game. It's the game that, you know, Taiwan gets forced to play. You know, just you'll play by our rules, and we'll allow you to trade in our country, or else we'll cut you off, and you, sir, will be voted out of office, and your economy will do poorly, and we'll deal with somebody else. And so it's a gang. Speaking of gangsters, give us an update on the dude who went to Lebanon. Is there any more information? Any more good information about the Japanese? Certainly are pissed because they look like stooges around the world as that guy has got to Lebanon. Is there any more news about how he actually did what he did?
It does seem as though three Americans, one of them former Special Forces guy, helped him get out of Japan. It seems as though he got down to Osaka from Tokyo, and then got on a private jet, and they put him in apparently a box or something, that a music instrument box or something, and the checks aren't all that great for private jets. And got him out that way. That's what you're reading. You know, what actually happened remains to be seen, but that could be a possibility. But I think the outrage on the part of Japanese prosecutors and officialdom is such that it's probably generating enough heat that you could probably you'd have enough electricity to power Tokyo for about 6 months if you could somehow bottle it. But they are really angry, and they're. They're not going to get him, Carlos Ghosn, back from Lebanon. I think that is most unlikely. But the prosecutors are going to use their sort of legal tools to make life really difficult for the Americans who helped him. And they are in more trouble than Ghosn is. If Japan decides to really push this, but they really are just starting to look stupid. They look as vindictive and vicious as, say, the old Barbary pirates, who want their pound of flesh. Instead of just letting it go, I think they can't help themselves. This is cutting off your nose to spite your face. But even worse here, and it goes unreported, it doesn't get much attention, is that when Carlos Ghosn was arrested, there was an American Nissan executive who was arrested along with him. He remains in Japan. He's out on bail, but he is stuck here for the foreseeable future. And unless the U.S. government, and probably it have to be at the Donald Trump level, weighs in and tells Japan to send him home. But they do have this American hostage, and I don't think that Japan Inc. or Japan's ruling class quite understands how this irritates some Americans, and including Americans who are longtime friends of Japan, me included. But there's that underreported aspect of the Carlos Ghosn affair, which I think does deserve attention, because if it's not handled right, this really could provoke a backlash in the U.S. against support for the Japanese. Here they're saying that we have this great alliance, we protect each other, but the Japanese elite takes an American hostage and mistreats him. And the way the Japanese legal system works is that if the American does not plead guilty to something, that they will keep him here and intimidate him and bully him and make life so miserable that I think it will eventually kill him. it always does in these cases, even involving Japanese, when they try to take on the Japanese authorities. So unless he gets sprung, that I'm not at all optimistic about his future. I would say it's an underreported bit that does deserve more attention, because it does provoke a bit of animosity amongst Japan supporters. So we'll see how that plays out.
All right. Next question. this is no longer the lightning round, just so everybody knows this. Okay. Do you have any inkling as to why there was no Christmas surprise present from our friend in North Korea? I've seen some speculation about it. Do you have a theory? What happened to the Christmas surprise?
I think that there wasn't one, would be my guess. Or it could, of course, be that there might have been, and China told Kim to knock it off. That is always a possibility. But this was this whole game that was being played. And if you look at North Korean behavior, it's really what they've been doing for 30 years. And there's always been the Americans falling over themselves to figure out how to de-escalate, how to make sure nothing happens, what can we give Kim so he doesn't do anything? And that's always been the American response to this. And you finally get an administration who's, just said, no, go ahead. And this is so out of character. But if you've been doing something for 30 years and it's worked, and then you keep doing it and the other side doesn't do what you think they are, well, at that point you have to put up or shut up. And I don't think they had anything to do. You think about it, and they could have shot a missile somewhere. They've tried that, but I think there may be some concern that with this president that this isn't the thing to do. So I was never all that concerned about it. But say this has been North Korea has done something. The Americans have always responded in a certain way. But with this administration, boy, just everything's different. And I think it put the North in a position where they didn't really have much of a surprise to offer. I think they could have sent a Hickory Farms gift basket or something. But that may have been their best option, actually, assuming they had the foreign exchange or a PayPal account to do it.
That might be a stretch, too, just for the record.
Yeah, but we do often have to, I think it's useful to step back every once in a while and consider just how different this administration has been in areas of foreign affairs. And in Indonesia, which is where I do focus a lot, it's really only been 3 years that we've started to actually act like this. When we could have at any time over the last 25. So,
let me ask you about also in the news. The president is very much looks to get to renegotiate deals, right? The great deal maker, and just last week, a big signing ceremony for the USMCA, the new version of NAFTA. And so he's also got an agreement with the Chinese. So seems to be doing pretty well relative to all of this. And so he has his sights next set on Europe and American manufacturers being able to export on the same footing that European companies export. Also in the news last week was South Korean employees on American military bases said they could be furloughed indefinitely in April if there is no agreement on cost sharing. Now, I think for domestic consumption here in the United States, it seems like, are we asking them to pay something that they should be paying? But I don't think any of us rightly knows. The ultimate question that always gets asked is, why are we more interested in your freedom than you are? So could you explain the cost-sharing arrangements with the South Koreans and the Japanese? Are they pulling their fair share of the weight? And is, you know, the president being unreasonable because he's known to do that?
In one sense, I don't think he's being unreasonable, but I think he's going after the wrong problem. What's going on here is the Americans towards both South Korea and Japan are saying, look, you guys have to spend more money to support our forces here. You know, just give more money to the U.S. Treasury so to defray the cost of U.S. forces being in your country. You know, cost us money to have troops there and do things to protect you. So spend more, you know, pay us more. And I think that's the wrong thing, you know, because let's take Japan's case, that Japan pays about $2 billion to the U.S. government in so-called host nation support. And the Trump administration apparently has asked for $8 billion a year in host nation support. So that'd be like a check written to the U.S. Treasury. It's not much money. It's about 20 minutes of Medicare fraud, probably, but it's not, just isn't much money.
Right.
But the bigger issue, you know, it should not be us demanding more money from our partners or allies, even though it is, they're getting a really good deal. In Japan's case, you know, if you were to replace the American security coverage, you would probably be up in somewhere well over $500 billion a year. Japan would have to double its defense budget at a minimum each year forever. So it's getting a really good deal. And so the budget would go from $50 billion to $100 billion a year, just like that. And that's for starters. So this extra $6 billion, you know, in one sense, it's a bargain. And there's something comparable going on with South Korea, where they are getting a bargain. You know, what is the price of the world's most powerful military? What's that worth, the support of it? And a promise to defend you. That's worth a whole lot of money. But that's the wrong thing to look at. Rather, the Trump administration should be demanding or insisting and doing everything it can to have these countries improve their defense capabilities, their own ability to fight and to fight alongside us. And that does require them to spend more money, but I would rather see them spend it on themselves, spend it in the right way so that you have as good and capable and powerful militaries as you possibly can, and able to operate with us in an effective way, which in the case of Japan, except for the two navies, they cannot. So that's where the pressure should be going, is they should be demanding Japan spend more, but not on us, but rather on their own Japan self-defense force. And something similar should be going on with Korea. But when it gets distilled down, when it gets distracted into something that like is going on now, arguing for more host nation support, it looks like we're shaking them down. We tend to appear as mercenaries, and they tend to look at us that way as well. You will actually find in Japan, and I'm very familiar with it, officials and politicians who will insist that since they are paying $2 billion to us, Japan needs to do nothing more to improve its own defense. It's as if this $2 billion fixes everything. So that's the wrong way to – that is not a good way to look at it. Americans don't like to these days don't like to die on behalf of ungrateful people who are unwilling to defend themselves. So that's where we should be pushing, is to have these both countries improving their capabilities. And if they are going to increase defense spending, spend it on themselves in the right way. And I've actually been told that when it comes to Japan, that on the U.S. side, for years, it was actually the so-called U.S. government officials who purposely did not push Japan to improve its capabilities because they thought that would offend China. How wrong can you be? But that was the thinking. So what they did was they said, well, okay, Japan, just spend more on host nation support and that'll be enough. But here we are with a JSDF, which really cannot fight except for the Navy. and certainly cannot operate with us very well. And now we're fussing over really little amounts of money that do not improve anyone's defense capability at all. So that's where I'd like to see the administration focus. But sometimes once you sort of latch on to an idea, that's hard to shift.
Right. No, it's certainly, plays to a sympathetic audience here in the United States as, people have looked, I think, at the president. And, he's been moderately successful with Europe. It's honestly, you look at what the exercises that are going on in Eastern Europe now, in Poland and with Lithuania, Poland and the F-35, that thing continues to move. Armored brigades from both Poland and Lithuania participating with American forces in Eastern Europe again. It's like, holy shit, and the president he's moved all that. And, he's consistently, he's been booting NATO countries in the ass about, you've got to live up to your obligation relative, to spending, 2% of your gross domestic product. Right. You cannot, again, America cannot be more invested, cannot be more interested in your freedom than you are. And so and it seems like, he's made headway with Europe and with NATO. And so not with everybody. The Germans are still, in my opinion, an absolute embarrassment as a nation. But, with other nations, he has. And I think, my own opinion is, look, if Germany's not going to do what they're supposed to do, then let's stop spending all that money. Let's, the Poles would love to have us there. And let's spend it in Poland, right? I think arguably the Polish food is better.
I like some of each, as long as there's a nice bat soup there as well. But the I think Mr. Trump has done very well. Actually, because what he's done is really nothing more than other administrations have tried, but they have all when the Europeans have just said yeah, we will take care of it. The Americans have just backed off, and here you have Mr. Trump who has not backed off, and he has kept up the pressure. He's taken advantage of opportunities where they do appear. And, that's the difference, is that instead of taking no for an answer or just being blown off as too many of the European countries, the big ones, have done, he has pushed it. And, that has made some progress. And sometimes just not being a sort of a patsy will get you some distance. And I think he has done pretty well. It'd be nice if the UK, of course, has shrunk their military to the point it's almost an embarrassment for people like our age who remember it very differently. But you could fit the entire Royal Navy down by Haynes Point in Washington in the river there. It's embarrassing what's happened to it. But you have an incredibly professional force, but the really the conservative governments in particular have participated in the shrinkage of the UK armed forces. That really is kind of an embarrassment. That hasn't gone as well as it should. But the Trump administration has done, as you've noted, it has made progress where it could, and in places where it hasn't done much. And you do find one interesting example is Norway. Is they'd love to have more Marines come if they could. But, right. And then there's other countries, like the Poles, as you mentioned, who are also very supportive. But we'll just see how this plays out. But it's really only been a few years now that somebody has actually refused to take no for an answer.
All right. What's the next thing you're writing?
Oh boy, well, I think it's something maybe about Wall Street falling head over heels to get into China. I think that's maybe going to be the next one. The idea being that even if we do shift our focus to Asia, the best and the brightest get to 3MEF, etc., and take on a stricter sort of policy towards the People's Republic of China, that you can do all of that But if at the same time America's financial industry is pouring money into this country that says it wants to destroy us, they're almost, you know, you hear Wall Street people always, they'll sometimes say, oh, we support the military, thank you for your service, etc. But they kind of also saying, well, go F yourselves, you know, here, well, we're going to go make it, you know, pour all of this convertible currency into China and do business. Well, you military guys, just go do what you want, but we're going to make a bundle. And so it's not incongruous. They shouldn't be, you see, we have one policy and then we have another one, which is completely opposite. So that's, I think, what I'm going to try to hit. So I'll, of course, get onto some other do not invite list somewhere.
You know, I saw an article in which either you were interviewed or mentioned in Stars and Stripes. Now you become somewhat of a now that everybody wants to be a Pacific expert, your status is becoming elevated, I think.
Maybe with All Marine Radio, at least, which I greatly appreciate. But no, I'm pretty much ignored. But that was an article about using Darwin as a sort of a launch pad for influence operations up into Southeast Asia.
And Darwin is the port in Australia, not the scientist, just so everybody knows.
That's right, yeah. It's right away up in the Northern Territory in Australia. It's only 200-300 miles from Indonesia, so it's way up there, and there's a lot of usefulness. So that's what I think quoted at length about this this idea, and it's not as if it took a genius to figure it out, or that I'm the first person to say it, but the reporter had heard some things I had said somewhere else and got a hold of me. But all publicity is not all publicity, but this was, you know, you never mind seeing you know, some idea get the light of day somewhere.
All right. Well, first of all, sir, always appreciate the time. How much? Now you're domiciled out of Hawaii. I'm going to Hawaii for the first time in my life.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Any recommendations relative to something I should see there or a place I should eat there?
I'd go to Chinatown for the bat soup if were me. It's all good. I think to not have been there for your entire life is quite an accomplishment.
Thank you. I mean, everybody's been there. I mean, really? They're like, oh, you haven't been? I'm like, look, everybody's gone there. Have you been to Ramadi? I have. Okay.
Okay. You have me there.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So don't try to make me feel like a stooge, but everybody does. You haven't been to Hawaii? Like it's some major transgression. Like everybody's been there. It's not a big deal. But I just, it was never a place. I always wanted to go to a place that was more, was a higher historical priority for me. Uh-huh. If I wanted to go lay on the beach, I could go do that in San Diego.
You have a point there, yeah. I see your point.
So if I'm going to travel, I would have gone to Germany. I would have gone to Japan. I would have gone to Italy where I could see history. So that's kind of my defense. I don't know if anybody buys it, but that's my defense.
Yeah, well, it's all good. I have a question. You know that tomorrow's the Super Bowl.
Yes.
I think. And I haven't followed the Chiefs very much. But is Lenny Dawson still the quarterback?
No,
Otis Taylor.
You're a little bit behind the times, my friend. You are a little bit behind the times.
Okay, well, I don't see how the 49ers are going to get past Willie Lanier and Buck Buchanan.
They were pretty good. You are dating yourself, but they were pretty good, and they used to have some pretty pretty good battles with the Oakland Raiders.
Yes. Okay. Well. And anyway. Haven't followed it much.
That have now moved to Las Vegas as of the end of the season. So
that's true.
So anyway, where I'm headed this week. So Anyway, all right, Grant. Well, first of all, I always appreciate catching up and appreciate the wisdom that you always lay on us. So thank you very much, and travel safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks. We'll talk to you later. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks, Grant. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.